to junior church, those ages 3 through 8 years old, may go on down. The rest of you, go ahead and grab your Bible and turn in it to our text this morning in Esther chapter 2. I trust that you're reading with us, staying right along with us. You know, some time ago, or this week, I heard a humorous little story about a young woman who was looking for Mr. Right. And she, you know, the kind of guy who would just treat you with kindness and flowers, and who would just do just act like a gentleman. She was looking for. So she placed an ad in the local newspaper in the classified ads, and said with her phone number in there, and right above it, husband wanted. Well, the next day she received dozens of calls from women saying, "You can have mine." I didn't think that was funny either. You know, I wonder about the messages that we're giving our young people about love and romance. Some of you who may be a little more mature, don't you like how I say that, you know? Those of you who are a little more mature, you may remember the days when Art Linkletter was on television and he had his program and where he wrote those books that kids say the darndest things. Well, I was doing some reading this week, and I came across some of those, and he asked some children, what happens or how love happens? What starts love? Well, third grade Janet said, "Well, no one really knows for sure how it happens, but I think it has something to do with how you smell." When 9-year-old Johnny was asked, "What does it mean to fall in love?" He said, "Falling in love is like an avalanche where you have to run for your life." He must have had some bad experiences, right? I love 6-year-old Eric. He was asked, "What is marriage?" And he said, "Well, marriage is when you get to keep your girl and you don't have to give her back to her parents." When they were asked, how do you make your marriage work? Ricky said, "You tell your wife she looks beautiful, even if she looks like a truck." I wonder, where do kids come up with all these things, you know? But 8-year-old Aaron was asked, how do you make love endure? And she said, "You make it endure by not forgetting your wife's name." That would be a mess. You find it fascinating what people think about love and romance. And, you know, in almost every romantic novel or movie, there are certain things always involved in it: flowers, cards, chivalry, kindness, a little perfume. That's all a part of the culture of romance. But that kind of romance is what fairy tales are made of. And that's why the book of Esther has all the trappings of a good fairy tale. You have the fair young maiden, you have the lonely king, and you have the kingdom-wide pageant. It's a real Cinderella story. And yet, as we dive further into the text today, I believe we're going to see that it's really not a love story at all. At least it's not a love story between a prince and a princess. The only love in this story is the love of father for his prodigal people, and how God is faithful even when we are faithless. Now, last week you may remember that the curtain closed on chapter 1 as the king goes off to war. He's had his war council, his 6-month and 1-week war council, where he tried to convince all of his leadership that he was capable of doing what his father had failed to be able to do, Darius I, and that was to defeat the Greeks. So he marches off to war. History informs us that Ahasuerus had the largest Persian army in history. And one inscription actually reveals that he intended to conquer not only Greece, but all of Europe as well. Now, certainly Western civilization would have been far different what it is today had this Iranian or Persian king been able to accomplish that. But history tells us that he was defeated at the Battle of Salamis in 480 B.C. With the Greeks had an army only half the size of Ahasuerus, but they defeated him and they routed out the enemy and they destroyed most of his navy. But with one of the few remaining remaining ships left, he sunk his way, or he slinked back to the city of Susan and where the palace was, palace was. And he's sullen and he's angry, he's dispirited, and that's where Esther chapter 2 now begins. And you look there in verse 1, it says, after these things, you see it there, you got it there, after these things, that's after all of these things, after the defeat at Salamis, he's now come back home, and after these things, the anger of the king Ahasuerus has abated, has subsided. And then he remembered Vashti, and what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Now, what's happening here is Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, he's back home now from his defeat. His war chest has been depleted. His credibility before his leaders and citizens has been called into suspect. He's sitting there in the palace, licking his wounds, brooding over all that has taken place over the last couple of years. And his mind now goes back to Vashti, his favorite queen. You remember his brain trust had convinced him in chapter 1 because she refused to come in to the drunken bout, I believe unclothed, and she said no to all of that. They had convinced him to dispose of her and get rid of her and to pass a law of the Medes and Persians that she could never come before the king again, and all the women of all the kingdom were us to obey their husbands. Well, the king's back home now. It's following all that defeat. He's thinking how not only had he lost the battle of Salamis, but he's also lost his favorite queen. And he's not in a good mood. And let me tell you, when Ahasuerus is in a bad mood, bad things can happen. And you need to understand, that's really the way the text is really written. The Hebrew text is really indicating that really now he's looking around him, looking for whom he can blame for all of this. Now history tells us that Ahasuerus, the kings of Persia, they had lots and lots of concubines who were lesser wives. They there was no ceremony involved in that, but they also had a number of wives that they were legally married to, that they could tap any one of them to be the queen, and just at the fancy and the whims of the king. And we know from history that Ahasuerus, another wife's name of Ahasuerus was Amaratris. She was the mother of Artaxerxes, who was the heir to the throne. Now Herodias, who was the Greek historian who lived a couple of decades after all of this, he tells us that she wasn't very well thought of by King Ahasuerus. He didn't think very well of her. We don't know what's happened to her by this time. Had she been deposed like Vashti? We don't know. Had she died by this time? Maybe. But what we do know, that Vashti, who had been the queen, king's favorite queen, now and who had been wearing the crown, is now gone. And as I mentioned to you last week, some historians, some Bible scholars believe that she had been beheaded. But you can almost see Ahasuerus here regretting now his taking the advice of his brain trust at this deposing of her. And maybe even he's sharpening his sword for them. So they scramble together as quickly as they can and say, we got to come up with something here. So in verse 2, they say, let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. Let's have an empire-wide search for a replacement for Queen Vashti. Now, what makes all this so very interesting is that Herodias, the Greek historian, informs us that the Persian custom required that the queen be related to one of the seven noble families or come from royalty of other empires. Now concubines, they could come from anywhere, but queens had to be women of dignity. So they were to come either from the royalty of other empires or from one of these seven noble families who happens to be the seven families of the seven wise men of the brain trust whom the king now is angry at. And so they're not about to suggest, you know what, king, you ought to take a wife from one of our kingdom, our families, that would look like it was self- self-serving, and would only get them into further trouble. They already knew they were in deep weeds with him. So they suggest, why don't you throw open the door and have a worldwide, empire-wide search for a replacement. And let's throw open the door of the palace and allow a commoner to become the queen. Now that was something that has never, ever happened in Persian history before. And that's why, against all Persian custom and tradition, you have God telling us this. And he's informing us that in spite of all the intrigue and all the scheming and drunkenness and pride, that he is setting the stage for a common little girl to come and to become the queen of this empire. Something has never happened before. Now they spell out the terms of all of this in verses 3 and 4. He says, let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom. And remember, the kingdom went from Africa to India. It was 127 provinces. And so appoint officers in all these provinces to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the citadel or the winter resort or palace, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. And let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the young women who please the king be queen instead of Vashti. Now Ahasuerus has a real opportunity here at this point to be a leader, to step up and show his leadership and say, you know what, guys, that's a stupid idea. Who's ever heard of picking a queen through a beauty contest, picking the most beautiful? But he doesn't do that, because all of this plays to his lustful side of his nature. It all plays to his fleshly side, this insecure, heartsick king. And so he allows his advisors, his wise men, once again to influence him, because it says there at the end of verse 4, this pleased the king, and he did so. Now, to the citizens of Persia, this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, let me tell you. Anybody could apply. Anybody could be the queen of this vast empire. And let me tell you, dear people, that was just kind of the talk of the town. You know, everybody was talking. Who's going to be the queen? Do you think it's going to be her? Or what about her? Or what about that one? So there would be a frenzy of activity and interest. Thousands would be waiting for these attendants to show up in their village or in their city, lining up to see if they could wear the glass slipper or not. And why not? Because, you know, the prize was the crown and the wealth and the security of being queen and the butlers and the maids and the money and the clothing and all the glitz and the glamour and acknowledgement and recognition. And you could leave a back-breaking life for a life in the palace. And so thousands must have stood in line waiting the arrival of the king's attendants. And yet, don't forget that this contest is different from any other. And there is but one judge, and the performances are private. They are within the bedroom of the king. And the young women who would line up and be a part of this contestant, and if they were chosen, and if they were not chosen to be the queen, they would not get to go back home, but they would be added to the harem. They, at best, would become concubines. And so while, yes, they would live in luxury in the palace, but you bundle with that at the same time, there would be extreme loneliness and despair. So let's get real with the text. I'll try to inform you, in spite of all the glitz and the glamour, we sometimes read this text. It is not as glorious and glamorous as it looks. You know, on the outside, there's a lot of things like that, isn't there? There's a lot of things in life that look so glamorous to us and so appealing, and yet when you get behind closed doors, they're not as appealing and glamorous as they appear. The enemy makes things look so good. Let us not forget that. And that sometimes things that look so great, they do not bring to you what you really want in your life at all. Now, history informs us that the eunuchs were in charge of these women in the harem to hold down the anger and the frustration that was there. And many of these women who would be added to the king's harem would just live a forgotten life, a sequestered life for the rest of their lives. One of the authors that I read said they get luxurious desolation. So things aren't always as pretty as they look. Now, in verse 5, though, we move on and we're introduced to the characters here now who appear in the story in verse 5. The first individual we meet is Mordecai. It says there, now, there was at the palace of Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai. And notice the lineage, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Joachim, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. Now, there's some debate here to all of this. Is this the father and the grandfather and the great-grandfather of Mordecai, or are they just leading figures within the lineage of Mordecai? Sometimes in Jewish lineages, they don't name every single individual within them, but just name some of the important ones. Now, we really don't know. I tend to believe, though, that what this is just a listing of some important names within the lineage of Mordecai. If you notice these names, you'll notice there's some names in there that you might recognize. Names like the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Who was the son of Kish? Anybody know the son of Kish who was a Benjamite? Who is the son of Kish in another place? Nancy? King Saul. So if that's the case, Mordecai was a descendant of royalty, of the royalty who had been disposed of within the Israel. You remember Saul was the rejected king. That may very well may explain why this guy didn't go back to Jerusalem. Why didn't he go back when Ahasuerus' great-grandfather gave permission for them to return? And this may be why, because Jerusalem represented for him and his family, that was the place where they were defeated. They were not the royal line anymore. Now added to all that is this whole name, Mordecai. The name Mordecai is a transliteration of the name Marduk, which was the chief Babylonian god. Now I don't know about you, but I read all that and I begin to think, what's a good Jewish guy doing in a place like this with a name like this? And all I could realize is that, yes, maybe he has been deposed. They were that of that royal line. They'd been rejected. And so his family is now living in disobedience, living in unbelief for generations perhaps by now. Hey, by the way, do you notice there's another name in that list that may be familiar to you in that list of genealogy? Have you ever heard of Shimei before? Shimei was another descendant of Saul's. Shimei was the guy when David was, when Absalom tried to seek a coup over his father, David, at the end of David's life. David was fleeing out of the city, and Shimei was the guy who was cursing David and throwing stones at him. Now, if this is the line of Mordecai, we might have some understanding why now his family refused to go back to Jerusalem, why his father went ahead and named him such a name. I believe that it's probably been for generations now, or several generations, that the family has not been living their faith. And Mordecai now is just drenched in the Persian culture. He's become Persianized, and he's wearing the name Marduk. And that may explain why here in just a few minutes you find that he advises Esther, keep your Jewishness a secret. Don't let anybody know who you really are. Now, before you really get all upset at Mordecai, I just got to ask you a question. What about your identity? Are you freely expressing who you are? Do you freely let people know who you are as a child of God? That you're a blood-bought saint? That you're a child of His? You belong to Him? That you have royalty spiritually in your veins? Do you let it be known about your relationship with Jesus Christ in your neighborhood, or what about at your on your campuses, or the places where you work? Now, have you ever thought about that? Or have you ever had this thought? You know, if people are going to know that I'm a Christian, they're going to have to know it by the way I live. They're going to have to look at me. You know, if Lord, if you want them to know I'm a Christian, you'll have to have them ask me. And yet, have you ever noticed nobody ever asks you? You know, there's an ancient two-syllable Hebrew word for that. Would you like to know how it's pronounced? It's pronounced cop-out. Cop-out. Nobody ever comes to know Jesus just only by your behavior. Nobody does it. No, nobody, you know, there's only one way for others to see your good works and to glorify your Father in heaven. The Apostle Paul tells us about it in Romans chapter 10. He says faith comes not by watching. Now certainly indeed your behavior and needs to match what you say, but people don't come to know Jesus just by watching. They have to hear. There has to be a communication of the gospel, and there has to be a communication of that which is true in your life, that your identity of who you are. There has to be a freedom to share that, a quickness to share who you are. Now, my belief is that Mordecai is not living a life of faith because he doesn't have much faith. He's not sharing a testimony because he doesn't have much of a testimony. I believe at this point, now, it's going to change, by the way. This is one of the things I love about the book of Esther. Mordecai is going to change in the next chapter. But at this particular point, he's really not living a life of faith at all. Now, let's move on. We've still got quite a ways to go here. But in verse 7, we're told that Mordecai was bringing up Hadassah, which is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, and she, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was beautiful of form and face. In other words, she was a beautiful figure and lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. Now here in this case, we're given both names, both the Hebrew and the Persian name. Her Hebrew name was Hadassah. It means a flower or flower petal of a low-growing myrtle bush or tree. And then her name, Esther, Astar. Scholars believe that name is the name of a Babylonian goddess of love. So apparently Esther now was an orphaned girl for both of her parents have died. We don't know how they died, but Mordecai takes her and he raises her as her own. Now, I know oftentimes we've been told that Mordecai was Esther's uncle, did you notice in the text what it says? She isn't his uncle. It says that she's the daughter of his uncle. Now, the daughter of my uncle is my cousin, Marilyn May. That she's 6 months older than I. We used to play together. But that's my cousin. So you know what? Esther and Mordecai are first cousins. Now history informs us that Mordecai was 15 years older than her. And so he takes her in and he raises her as his own daughter. Now, this is where it really gets interesting, because Mordecai apparently gets wind of this contest, and he, at the encouragement of Esther, and they're not acting in faith here at this point. But you notice in verse 8 what happens. It says that it came about when the king's order and his edict was proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered, this is the first wave, by the way, in Susa, the palace in custody of Haggai, Esther was also taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who was in charge of the women. Now, we don't know how old Esther is at this point, but she comes and gets, she's a part of the contestants here. Now, Josephus, the first century historian, tells us that there were over 1,000 contestants in this, just in the first wave. In fact, he tells us that there were 1,460 contestants, to be exact. So in other words, this was not like your Miss America beauty pageant with only about 50 participants in it. that there are over a thousand young women, all beautiful, in this contest. Now, some people have taken that word in verse 8 that she was brought or taken. There, you see Esther was taken into the king's palace. Someone would say that was by force. You have a little hard time with that with the text. She really was a willing participant here at this point. She was willing to follow the advice, I believe, of Mordecai and to become a contestant in this contest for the queen. Now there are at least three reasons why she shouldn't win or didn't have a good chance of winning. For one is that she was an orphan. She had no family convection. So there would be no family who would be a help to her, who might influence her to win. Secondly, she was up against fierce competition. Did you hear me say that there was 1,460 contestants in this contest? And listen, they were all beautiful. They all turned heads. People were watching. They were beautiful women. And then lastly, she was a Jewess. And the Jews were a defeated nation. Now, at this point, we don't know whether there was anti-Semitism going on or not, or persecution of the Jews, but they were a defeated nation. They were outsiders. Yes, they had bought into the Persian culture, and in many ways, though, they had strayed from the covenant of their God, and they were outsiders looking in. In fact, if the news would have leaked that she was a Jewess, whatever slim chance she might have had of winning would have disappeared. And at best, she would have been a concubine. I think that's no doubt why in verse 10, it says there that Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her not to make it known. In effect, I think what Mordecai really was saying to Esther is, Esther, we're on our own. And you know that God of the Jews, he's back there in the old country. That's past, that's history. He's back in Jerusalem. But here we're on our own. And if we're going to win, it's up to us to make it happen. And it's up to our wit and ourselves. And Mordecai is implying that once Esther gets into the king's chamber, it's all left up to her. But he couldn't have been further from the truth. Because the truth is, God was at work. The shadow sovereign was working. God was doing things that Esther and Mordecai had no idea of. Now, are you with me? Listen to me here. I know you're tired this morning. I tell that. And we're going through a lot of text this morning. But you asked me, how do you know that God was at work? It's an interesting thing to see. If you look back at verse 9 there, it says, the young women pleased him. That's Haggai, the administrator of this contest of all these 1,460 women. I imagine about this time he was hating his job, don't you? And yet it says there that she won his favor. That's an interesting word, favor. Anybody have any idea what that word favor is what Hebrew word it's a translation of? I shared it with you when we were studying through the book of Ruth last month. It is this word kashed. It's the word that is commonly used throughout the Old Testament as the word that describes God's loyalty and love towards his covenant people. Normally in the King James Version of the Bible, it is translated loving kindness. It's God's loving kindness. Kashed towards his people. But sometimes this word is used when other people show God's kind of love. It's used when they express God's love. Now it's not a man-manufactured love. It's not a man-made love. It's a God's love being expressed through someone. That's what we have here in verse 9. In verse 9, we have the fact that it's God's love, it's his loving kindness that is being displayed through this servant, Haggai. They don't even know it, but God is showing forth his love, his kindness, his favor. You might want to circle that word. It's an important word. Yeah, while God's name is not mentioned anywhere, his love is being expressed here. Now, it's very interesting. If you look down to verse 15, do that. Look at verse 15. In fact, you might even want to draw a line down to verse 15 because the same word is used in verse 15 where it says, now Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. She found kesed, God's kind of favor. Now, don't read that so fast that you miss that. You would expect it to read that she found envy in the eyes of all who saw her. She found jealousy in the eyes of all who saw her. There were over 1,000 plus girls who were all competing for the same prize that she was. And when she walked into the room, you would expect them to look at her with envy and jealousy and hatred and with how can we bump her off? But rather, they show her kashed, loving kindness, God's love and kindness. You know, God may be not seen in the text, but he is there. He's working. He's working. You may not see him in your life, but he's working. He may be showing his kashed to you through somebody else, showing you favor and kindness. Now, what's really interesting is that here's somebody who comes up on the scene who's really a nobody, comes out of the shadows. She's an insignificant nobody. Nobody knows who she is. And yet she is being positioned in a place, not by Mordecai, but by Almighty God. And she's being positioned because the dark clouds are swarming on the horizon of an upcoming Holocaust that will take all the people of God away and the promises and covenants of God away. And so unbeknown to her, unbeknown to Mordecai, unbeknown to anybody, God is putting her in place. God is at work here, showing his kashed, his favor. Notice in verse 9, it goes on to say there, that Haggai quickly provided her with her cosmetics. She had the Avon lady on standby, okay? And her portion of food, he provided all that for her. And he gave her 7 choice young women from the king's palace. She gets her own assistants. He advances her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Look at what happens to Esther. In just a matter of a few hours, she's brought clear up to the front. She's given everything she needs. But it's not so good with Mordecai. What's Mordecai doing? Look at verse 11. He's pacing back and forth out in front of the palace, wondering what's happening to Esther. Is she faring well? Is she able to keep our secret? She's so naive. What can I do? I wish there was something I could do. But Mordecai doesn't realize that he doesn't have to do anything because God is at work. God is at work. Now while Mordecai is pacing back and forth outside, you look in verse 12 and you find what Esther's doing on the inside. It says in verse 12 there, now when the turn came for each young woman to go in to King Ahasuerus after the end of her 12 months under the regulations of the women. Listen, I mean, this was a 12-month long process. Getting these women ready to go before the king. 12 months, a whole year. But after the end of the 12 months, under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for the women. Now, can you imagine that? You guys think it takes long enough for your wife to get ready to go anywhere. This took 12 months. 6 months with cosmetics just to put her makeup on. Are you ready yet, honey? Well, yeah, almost. I got another 5 months and 3 weeks to go. I say 6 months of the oil of myrrh massages. These ladies had come in and probably out of the field, many of them with darkened skin and maybe callous skin. They had been working hard, but they had to be made soft. The Persians thought that the fairer you looked, the more beautiful you were. Just the opposite of what we Americans tend to think. We tend to think we want a suntan. We want a bronze-looking complexion. But the Persians thought if the fairer skin you were, the more beautiful you were. And so they brought him in and worked with it. They had a whole science of cosmetology. I wish I could read to you all the things that I read this week about the makeup these gals put on. There were all kinds of things. And the reason that was because they believed that beauty brought them closer to God. It was the priest who guarded the science of cosmetology. It was the priest who took care of all the cosmetics. How would you like it, ladies, to have to come see the priest to get your cosmetics? Well, that's what was going on. It was 12 months here. It was also they were being schooled in royal etiquette. They were being taught what to say and how to say it. They're coming from all these different provinces. They no doubt were coming in from the fields, many of them uneducated, and so they had to be taught to learn to read and write. And one of the people I read said that they had to learn, this was a crash course on how to look like a queen, sound like a queen, eat like a queen, and even smell like a queen. Now, by the way, it's very interesting, though, as you study through all this, you don't find Esther protesting any of this. Now, nothing like you read about Daniel, who a few years before this, when he had been taken captive by the Babylonians, you remember Daniel purposed in his heart not to eat the non-kosher food and not to drink the king's wine, which was a libation to the gods. Daniel said no, but as far as we know, Esther did not protest at all to the non-kosher foods, because listen, she was keeping her identity a secret. She was not living her Jewishness at all. She was hiding who she was. And so therefore, she was giving in to all kinds. I know that at the beginning of the first century, there was a group of rabbis who added 100 verses to the text in Esther, and one of them says that she didn't eat any of the king's food, or the non-kosher food, but that was all added. Esther is not living a life of faith here at this point. Esther is not living as she should be here at this point. Here's one of the things that was said, that one of the verses added, that was added by these guys to the text, but it's not true. Now, so as much as theologians and pastors would like to pretty up and to sanitize all of this, it's not a pretty scene. And the next scene is really even worse. One of the commentators I read said, it's really kind of like a meat market. All these women come in and parade before the king one by one. And Esther would lose her virginity to a pagan king along with dozens of others. But only one would be chosen. And yet the interesting thing that we find is that God is faithful even when his people are unfaithful. In fact, one of the modern pastors that I listened to this week, a more recent one, he wanted to take that whole phrase that's found there in verse 16 when it says that Esther was brought to the king. He said she was brought kicking and screaming. But that's not really true. Because it's very interesting. It's the same verb and voice that is used in verse 15 where it says Mordecai had taken Esther as his own daughter. Now, he didn't take her kicking and screaming to be his daughter. Esther went willingly into the king and surrendered herself to his whims and wishes. Now, I don't know what that does to you with your beautiful picture of Esther. Now, Esther will become a godly woman, I believe. But at this point, she is not living her faith. And that can speak volumes to those of us who have a past that we are ashamed of. Just because your past may be bad does not mean your future has to be. But Esther has surrendered herself to the king. She's coming in with her best outfit on. She's coming with her face all made up with makeup. Her body was all drenched in perfume. She even went in with a few secrets from Haggai, how to win the crown, how to give herself. He gave her some inside scoop on the king's lustful sensual desires. Look at verse 16. Verse 16, we read, and when Esther was brought to the king Ahasuerus into the royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins so that he set the royal crown on her head and he made her queen instead of Vashti. Now, I don't know about you, but when I know what really went on, this really is a lot more hollow than it used to seem. There's no jumping up and down here. Hurrah, hurrah, Esther's become the queen. Miss Persia. And how many young women will give their virginity to some young man simply because he says, if you love me, you'll do this. And they've entered the meat market. And oh, by the way, many will discover that he really didn't mean what he said, and he was a liar. Or how many professionals have kept their faith a secret so that it doesn't get in the way of their climbing the corporate ladder? Or I wonder how many of us are living like Persians so that we might receive a Persian pat on the back. You're one of us. We think you're pretty cool. We like you. And yet Esther, listen, she may have gained the crown, but she did not get a faithful husband. Verse 17 just says there that Esther, the king loved Esther more than all the other women. Now, it doesn't mean he didn't love the other women. You know what? It's interesting. Nowhere in the text does it say that he sends home all the rest of the queens and the concubines and say, we have no more need of you. I have found my wife. Don't try to paint this picture as something really good because it isn't. In verse 19, we read that when the virgins were gathered together, the what? They were gathered together the what? The second time. Why were they gathered together again? And by the way, it's written in such a way that this is a whole new batch of virgins. The queen has already been chosen. Esther's the queen. Well, now why is the king gathering another bed? You know why? He's adding to his ever-expanding harem. He will do that for the next 10 years until history informs us that ironically someone slips into his bedchamber and slits his throat. This is a womanizer. He uses women. I couldn't help but think of the warning that God gives us in Hebrews 13. Listen, my friends, God has a reason for saying what he says. God says we're to keep ourselves for our husbands and our wife, only those whom we are married to. And yet our culture today, so many women in our culture want to say, well, everybody else is doing it, must be okay. No, listen. God wants this reserved between you and your wife only. As a symbol of your oneness and your unity together before God. Now, Esther's lost all that. Oh, she'll occupy the place of queen, all right. But she didn't win a faithful husband. And she didn't win a wonderful relationship with a man, an honest relationship. She has to keep her secret. The secret that she's a Jew and she keeps it a secret for the next 5 years. Can you imagine that? For 5 more years, she keeps it a secret from the king whom she's married to. Afraid that somebody's going to put 2 and 2 together, and yet here she is, she's trying to keep it a secret, and she keeps it a secret until it's almost too late. And yet here's the point. Yes, God works his will through faithful people. Yes, he does. But my dear friends, God also works his will through unfaithful people. That's what we learn in the book of Esther. Yes, God is sovereign, and we see something of his providence all the way through the book here. We see God at work, but there's another thing we see here in this text. Something that we do not talk very much about, and that is the doctrine of grace. Have you ever thought about how the grace of God meets us in our most sinful places? I think of that verse in Romans where it says, but where sin abounds, grace, what? Much more. But we don't talk very much about that. All because we don't want people to go out and sin it up. They're afraid that we're going to give them a license to sin. If we teach them that God's grace will meet you in your weakest moment, somehow people are going to think that means I can go out and do anything I want and I can sin up a storm, and then we become guilty of what has been labeled as cheap grace. Now, dear friend, I don't know what people mean when they're labeled by cheap grace. I've been labeled by that, by the way. Just recently, somebody, another pastor in town, labeled me as a pastor of cheap grace. Grace is not cheap, by the way. Grace cost our Lord Jesus dearly in all of his life. He gave it up so that it was love, so he could give you life. And listen, when we display grace to people who do not deserve grace, it costs us a great deal. It has cost me a great deal to love people who are broken. People who do not deserve it. People who on the outside said you ought to be judging them and throwing them out. And yet, what do we read here? Does Esther deserve God to use her? Does Mordecai, have they somehow earned the favor of God? Oh, I know that's how we've read the text before, but there is no earning of God's favor here. But God reaches down to two cousins who are broken, who are living in sin, who are doing things that are horrendous. And yet God uses them in his grace. Esther chapter 2 is drenched with the utter depravity and sinfulness and disobedience, but it's also drenched with God's grace, one author said. As you know, as I read through the text this week, I studied through the text, that the perfume I smelled all week as I read that was God's wonderful grace. How in his mercy and his love, he reaches down and touches us. He displays his chesed, his loving kindness to us. Did Esther deserve all this? By the way, you know what would have happened to Esther if she'd lost? She wouldn't have gone back home. You look at verse 13 and 14. You read that the young women went into the king as young women, but they come out as concubines. At best, Esther would have been just a concubine if she'd lost. And yet what we have is the loving chesed of Father working here to put this woman who doesn't deserve it, who doesn't earn it. By the way, I never go to God and say, use me because I'm faithful. Any of you ever pray to God that way? God, I use me because I'm so faithful, because I'm so good. No, I go to him and say, God, I want you to use me in spite of me. I want you to display your love and grace through me. I want to be a display of you. And it was all done so that Esther could be in that place at the right moment, at the right time. And Esther's life's going to change, and Mordecai's life's going to change. We'll see that. But God is working in grace. He's working in grace. The life of joy and satisfaction in life, it doesn't test the providence of God. It trusts the providence of God. I get up in the morning and I say, oh, Lord, I trust you today. I don't know what my day is going to bring to me. I don't know how the day is going to come. But, Lord, I trust you that you will work, that you'll give me opportunities to express your grace, your kindness, that I can be a living testimony of you and that I may speak forth those words of grace. Of grace. That I may lift up someone that is broken and help them be on their way so that they can be a blessing and channel of his grace. Lord, you've heard us. We've talked. We've looked at the text. And this morning, what we really desire is that you would use us. But Lord, we know that That is not contingent on our deserving it, but it's contingent upon your grace. Lord, if there's someone here that's never yet bowed their heart to you and received your life, may they do that just right now in the quietness of these moments, putting their faith and trust in you. In Jesus' name we pray.